Welcome to That Was Radio, where we explore all aspects of the golden age of radio. Not just the radio programs themselves, but also the personalities and events that shaped those programs. I'm Leon Smothers for WMKY, Morehead State Public Radio. In a previous program, we talked about the impressive contributions women made to primetime dramatic programs during the golden age of radio, that is, the 1930s through the 1950s. In this program, we're going to look at their contributions through primetime comedy. As previously, we'll only consider those programs that ran for at least 2 years. Where possible, I will introduce each comedian with an instrumental version of a theme song from one of the programs associated with her. In the early days of radio, many women were successful as singers, musicians, and actors, but very few had success in comedy. In large part, this was due to the bias held over from vaudeville days that women couldn't do comedy. While women could be part of a comedy team, it was held that they weren't funny alone. And even when they were part of a team, they were mostly relegated to the role of a dumb dame or a silly wife and were the brunt of the jokes, not the ones getting the laughs. Many of the early comedy programs on radio featured husband and wife comedy teams. However, as opposed to vaudeville, it was very often the women who delivered the lines that got the biggest laughs. One of the best-loved comedy couples was Burns and Allen. Before they met, each had worked in vaudeville. In 1922, Gracie was part of a company that toured the country, beginning on the West Coast and ending in New Jersey. When the company broke up, she found herself in New York City without a job. Her family sent her money to keep her going while she tried to find work there. One of her roommates was working in a comedy act at a small theater where George Burns and his partner were also performing. When the roommate heard that the team was breaking up, she convinced Gracie to catch their act to see if she might want to work with one of them. The team of Burns and Allen made its stage debut in Newark, New Jersey in 1923, with Gracie doing the straight lines. It didn't go so well. George was supposed to be the comic, but Gracie was getting all the laughs with her straight lines. George realized that, to make the act work, he needed to change the routine and give Gracie most of the punchlines. Before long, Burns and Allen was one of the hottest comedy teams in vaudeville, and in 1926, they cemented their partnership by getting married. The duo first appeared on radio in 1929 while on tour in England, where they were enthusiastically received. They were introduced to American audiences in 1931 and got their own show in 1932. There are two famous running gags associated with Burns and Allen. The first is Gracie's search for her supposedly lost brother, in which she appeared for brief cameos on other radio programs and even on other networks. The other was Gracie running for president on the surprise party. Here is Gracie announcing her campaign.
Bubba, sit down and take a letter.
All right. Now, is the letter important or can I leave my gloves on?
Well, it's
Gracie, you better talk quietly. She uses a soft pencil.
Letter. Frank, what's today's date?
Elsie, Edna couldn't make it.
February 28th.
All right, I'm ready.
Oh, good. To all other presidential candidates, semicolon, United States of America, period, gentlemen, question mark.
Gentlemen, question mark?
I've got it. Well, boys, the jig is up.
Well, that's a nice opening.
Election day will be in November this year. Turkeys will cost you 38 cents a pound. Cranberries will be 50 cents a bucket. Plum puddings will be $2 each. But a good president won't cost you a nickel, so be sure and go out and vote for me.
You're asking the other presidential candidates to vote for you?
Well, sure, there's so many presidential candidates that if I only get half of them to vote for me, I'm bound to be elected.
I see what you mean.
Go ahead, continue.
This letter is being dictated by a lady, typewritten by a lady, so don't forget to take your hats off while you're reading it.
I've got it.
All right. Signed, Gracie Allen, President of the United States, and mail it out right away.
Gracie, you're not president yet.
Well, I will be by the time this letter is delivered.
That's some letter.
And Bubbles make 50,000 copies.
One for each candidate.
Yes.
I thought so, yes.
Bubbles, address the envelopes in girlish handwriting. Mark it personal and send it to their homes. I want their wives to read it, too.
In 1950, Burns and Allen left radio and moved their act to television, where they appeared until Gracie retired in 1958. The Easy Aces was another popular husband and wife team, though not as well known as Burns and Allen. Goodman Ace was an intelligent and gifted writer. By the age of 20, he was the movie and vaudeville critic for the Kansas City Post. When Jack Benny came to town, Ace met Benny, who was impressed with the young man's sense of humor. For years afterwards, Ace supplied jokes for Benny's vaudeville act. In 1922, Ace married Jane Epstein. As opposed to most showbiz couples, the Aces became a comedy team by accident. One evening in 1929, when Ace was doing a movie review on radio and Jane was waiting for him in the studio, the station was unable to pick up the network program that was supposed to follow Aces. Ace began talking to fill airtime. After a while, he was running out of ideas and motioned for Jane to come in to join him. They started ad-libbing about various topics and began making up a story about a woman who had murdered her husband in an argument over a bridge game. During their discussion, Jane asked, "Would you care to shoot a game of bridge, dear?" The first of the malapropisms for which she became known. The response to this impromptu broadcast was so enthusiastic that the couple got their own program. From 1931 to 1948, audiences were entertained by Jane's wacky character and Ace's perpetual frustration with his wife. This was another case where the husband was the writer and comedy genius, but realized that his wife was just plain funnier. Over the years, he wrote such lines for Jane as, "I'm his awfully wedded wife," "The chickens have come home to roast," and "You could have knocked me over with a fender." A favorite comedy team of radio's golden age, and still very popular today, is Fibber McGee and Molly, which starred Jim and Marion Jordan. Jim Jordan and Marion Driscoll grew up a few miles apart outside of Peoria, Illinois. Both were talented musicians and dreamed of a career in music. Jim was a tenor, and Marion had a beautiful contralto voice and could play both the piano and the violin. After they married in 1918, they spent several hard years on the small-time showbiz circuit. In 1924, they started getting jobs on Chicago radio stations and worked their way up the ladder until one of their programs, called Smack Out, was picked up by NBC in 1933. During this period, the Jordans met Don Quinn, a gifted writer who worked with them for the next 20 years. In 1935, the Johnson Wax Company was looking for a new program to sponsor. They liked what the Jordans were doing, and Fibber McGee and Molly was born. This program certainly went against the vaudeville typecast, as it was the husband that was the scatterbrain. The Jordans had a great working relationship and were equal contributors to their successful careers. Marion created a variety of quirky characters, demonstrating her versatility and vocal talents. Notably, she played a little girl named Teenie, who was continually arguing with McGee. Let's listen as Teenie drops in at the McGee's with her cat.
Come in.
Hi, mister.
Oh, hello there, Teenie. To what do I owe the doubtful play? Hey, what you got there?
Well, it's a kitty cat.
Oh.
Isn't he cute?
Mm-hmm.
I've always wanted a little kitty cat, but my mama says cats carry germs, but this one isn't carrying any because I held him over the garbage can and shook him, I bet you.
Well, what's a few germs between friends, anyway? Personally, I think it's a wonderful thing for children to have pets.
Well, so does my mama, too, but she says the trouble is when the pets start having children.
Hey, he sounds like he's hungry.
Oh, he can't be hungry, I bet you.
No?
I gave him a saucer of root beer and 2 chocolate marshmallows and half my bubble gum.
He did, eh?
Yes, he was so hungry.
I says you did, eh?
Did what?
Gave him all that stuff to eat.
What stuff?
A saucer of root beer, 2 chocolate marshmallows, and half your bubble gum.
Well, you forgot the dill pickle. I gave him that the very first thing.
Well, I'm sorry. I'll remember that in the future.
I'm not going to give him any more in the future. It made him sick. Oh, don't cry, Raymond. I won't give you any more pickles.
Raymond, eh? That's a cute name for a cat, sis.
I don't like it.
Hmm?
I think Raymond is a bum name for a cat, I betcha.
Well, then why call him Raymond?
I have to. That's his name.
Well, who named him?
I did.
Well, if you don't like the name Raymond for a cat, why did you name him Raymond?
I named him before I found out he wasn't that kind of a cat.
The Fibber McGee and Molly program was one of the most popular on radio and entertained listeners until September 1959. After the program ended, Marion Jordan's health began to decline. She died in 1961, just days before her 63rd birthday. The final husband and wife team was not a married couple in real life, but played one on radio. And although the show was called My Favorite Husband, it was really the wife who was the central figure. In retrospect, many radio historians have dubbed My Favorite Husband as a sort of warm-up act for Lucille Ball's I Love Lucy. Ball was at mid-career at this point. Poised to make the transition from mediocre B-movie actress, Ball's character in this program, Liz Cooper, takes social climbing to laughable, if often ludicrous, new heights. As an only slightly toned-down Lucy Ricardo, Liz is zany enough that the resemblance is unmistakable. Liz's husband, George, is just a run-of-the-mill banker. Well, he's actually the fifth vice president of the local bank. But Liz has bigger plans for him and will do most anything to make them happen. Over his strong protests, she contrives all sorts of schemes to improve their status in an effort not just to be accepted by their peers, but elevated somewhere above them. In the following clip, we find Liz cooking dinner for George's boss and his wife, and eight important out-of-town business guests.
As we return to the Coopers, it's several hours later, and we find the kitchen knee-deep in dirty saucepans, greasy skillets, broken eggshells, and well-thumbed cookbooks.
Hello. Is that you, Liz?
Yes.
I just got home from the beauty parlor. How's it going?
Oh, sure.
What happened, girl?
You wouldn't believe me if I told you.
Well, tell me. How'd the two chickens turn out?
Which two?
Well, I know you burned two. What about the other two?
Which two?
Will you stop saying which two? Tell me what happened.
Iris, you're talking to a woman who's gone through eight chickens today. The pressure cooker exploded.
Well, what about the chickens?
They look delicious.
What do you mean they look delicious?
I can't get them down off the ceiling.
About five and six.
Gone.
Gone?
I got so confused cleaning up after three and four, I threw five and six in the garbage disposal.
This is unbelievable.
Finally, the butcher ran out of dressed birds and sent out two live ones.
Well, did you cook them?
Cook them. I can't even catch them.
Well,
When last seen, 7 and 8 were going east on Bundy Drive.
Oh, you poor thing. 8 chickens and nothing to show for it.
Oh, yes, I have. Before she left, 7 laid an egg on the kitchen table.
You're listening to a salute to the great comedians of radio's golden age on That Was Radio. This is WMKY 90.3 FM. I'm Leon Smothers. My Favorite Husband first aired in July of 1948 and was on CBS until March of 1951. I've not discussed Mary Livingston or Portland Hoffa, who appeared regularly on radio with their husbands Jack Benny and Fred Allen, respectively, because they were not by any means featured on those programs. Much the same can be said about Penny Singleton in her role as Blondie. Despite the show's name, the plots all revolved around her daffy husband, Dagwood, and the predicaments in which he became entangled. Probably the biggest argument against the vaudeville adage that women weren't funny was Fanny Brice, probably the funniest solo comedian ever on radio. Brice came to radio after a long and successful career in burlesque, vaudeville, and Broadway. She was a very talented singer and dancer, as well as being extremely funny. Brice's famous radio persona was Baby Snooks. The character of Snooks was a creature of evolution more than creation. As part of Brice's vaudeville act, she did a song called Poor Pauline, singing it in different dialects and as several personalities of the day might have done it. Then, at a party one night, she sang it as a very young child would, with wide eyes, exaggerated mouth, and feet spread wide apart, to the great delight of all attending. Many years later, the little girl character would take the form of Baby Snooks during the Ziegfeld Follies of 1932. Snooks appeared on various NBC programs from 1936 to 1944. Then Baby Snooks got her own show that ran for 4 years on CBS, and then after a year and a half gap, aired for a final year and a half on NBC, ending with Brice's death on May 29th of 1951. During the show's run, Snooks was depicted as being a 4 to 6 year old little girl with a marvelous talent for being annoying and pestersome, and on more than a few occasions, petulant, obstinate, and whiny. While Brice often claimed that Snooks wasn't really bad, let's consider a few of the things that she did on the show. She planted a bee's nest at her mother's club meeting, put marbles into her father's piano, and buried her brother upside down in sand at the beach. I think most parents would agree that's more than being just spirited. Let's listen as Snooks and Daddy look at Baby Robespierre's first tooth.
Look at that little angel. What a beautiful complexion.
Looks like a lobster.
Well, he is a little red. Maybe Robespierre will open his mouth. Then you can see his tooth.
Stick a pin in him.
I should say not. How can you think of hurting that little mite? He's so sweet and innocent. Look at that firm little chin, that well-shaped head. Ah, what a child. Snooks, you're thinking, aren't you?
Yes, Daddy.
I thought so. What are you thinking about?
How long is a snake's tail?
Ah, you haven't got an ounce of sentiment in your body.
Boring again.
Oh, look, look, Snooks. Right there in front. See the tooth? Isn't it wonderful?
What's wonderful about it?
Well, it's his first tooth.
Can he take it out?
Oh, of course not. Nobody takes the teeth out.
You always take...
Never mind that. My teeth have nothing to do with you.
Why you put them in a glass...
Snooks! Now, I'll thank you not to bandy my teeth about. I'm not as young as I used to be, and these things happen.
Why?
Well, let me explain something to you. To begin with, whether you like it or not, in a very short time, all of your teeth will fall out.
I like it.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. I'll stick them in a pumpkin for Halloween.
Very fine. All I'm trying to tell you is that your mouth is full of deciduous teeth.
I don't taste nothing.
Well, of course not. It just means you lose them. They are milk teeth.
Can I milk them?
No. And remember, sirs, when a tooth falls out, put it under your pillow.
What for?
Well, a brownie will come while you're asleep and turn the tooth into a dime.
I want to put one out now.
Oh, don't be silly. I'm just trying to impress on your mind that teeth are vitally important to your health. You know how many types of teeth there are?
No.
Well, there's the incisors, the canines, the bicuspids, the molars, and later on you'll get wisdom teeth.
Wisdom teeth?
Yes.
When did you get yours?
Mine came very late. As a matter of fact, I didn't get my wisdom teeth until after I was married.
Too late, huh?
It's not necessary to make those remarks. Young kid's uncanny.
Uh-huh.
Nothing. Snooks! Don't try to loosen your teeth.
Can't pull one out.
What for?
I want the brownie to change it into a dime.
Oh, your teeth are still too tight. You'll have to be patient.
Oh. It's Robespierre's teeth looser than mine?
Oh, I suppose so. Now, let's go back to the study.
You go, Daddy. I want to stay here a little while.
The last few years of the Baby Snook Show were sponsored by Tums Antacid Tablets. I suspect that Snook's daddy was one of their best customers. Joan Davis was another multi-talented comedian, though she is better known for her work in film and television than on radio. Davis appeared on stage as a child, and after she married, worked with her husband in vaudeville. In 1934, at the age of 22, she moved to Hollywood and soon began to land spots in comedy shorts. Davis was tall, thin, and attractive, with a distinctive nasal voice, a rubbery face, and the ability to take a pratfall. She worked regularly in comedies over the next 6 years and in progressively more significant roles. By 1941, she was recognized as one of the top comedians in film. That was the year Joan made her radio debut. Near the end of 1941, she was a frequent guest on the Rudy Valley Show on NBC, and at the beginning of 1942, she became a regular on the show. When Valley joined the Coast Guard in 1943, Davis and Jack Haley took over as co-leads on the Seal Test Village Store. 2 years later, Davis moved to CBS, where she had several shows of her own: Joanie's Tea Room, Joan Davis Time, and Leave It to Joan. These were all basically the same show under three different names, a combination of sitcom and variety show in which Joan, although quite attractive, played the man-crazed store proprietor. The following is from a live performance of the Seal Test Village Store for an audience of waves. It's from April of 1944.
Oh, gee, it's going to be swell to be a wave. Of course, I'll have to give up my boyfriend. Waves don't go out with men. Some ill-informed civilian once told me. Of course, there's only one boyfriend I'll miss. That's Joey. Joey's my one love. He's my man. I think I'll sing about him. Oh, my man, I love him so. He'll never know. All my life is just despair, but I don't care. Yes, oh yes, he's my man. He's wonderful. He used to be so romantic. You know, every day he'd send me a little remembrance from his very own flower garden. He was trying to worm his way into my affections. I didn't win him, but at the end of the year I had 365 worms. And I'll never forget the night of my 18th birthday party. The streets were wet, and my boyfriend said it was unhealthy to get one's feet wet. He was just like Sir Walter Raleigh. He spread out a lovely camel hair coat over a big puddle, but I still got full of mud. He should have spread out the coat, and he shouldn't have spread it out until I took it off. And 10 of us drove to the party in one car, and it was terribly crowded. We never could have squeezed in if it hadn't been for my boyfriend. He gave us all some green apples that he had swiped, and we ate them. Then we took turns doubling up in the back seat. Ah, that's what you like.
And that was that night he said we were engaged. And he put a ring on my finger. But he changed his mind later and broke it off. I didn't mind losing the ring, but where am I going to get another finger? You know, maybe I shouldn't take men so seriously. My mother always told me there was no need to get married until I was a ripe old age. But now I'm getting worried. I'm not only ripe, I'm squashy. For no matter what you do, I love you forevermore.
After Leave It to Joan ended in mid-1950, Joan Davis moved to NBC television in the sitcom I Married Joan, which ran from 1952 to 1955. Another very funny lady was Judy Canova. She was born in Florida in 1913. By the time she was 12, she was performing with her older sister and brother in a trio known as the Three Georgia Crackers. The Canovas told jokes and sang songs on the radio in the Jacksonville area, which led to bookings for nightclub performances in New York. The trio was signed to the American Record Company in 1931, cutting hillbilly novelty songs, and later appeared in a Broadway revue entitled Calling All Stars. A few years later, Judy was a featured act in the Ziegfeld Follies of 1936 and starred in her own show on Broadway in 1939. In the meantime, she had appeared on radio on a number of shows, including Rudy Valley's and Paul Whiteman's, and had been in several movies. The Judy Canova Show debuted in 1943 and ran 12 years on CBS and NBC. Although she was an intelligent and sophisticated woman, Canova played a love-starved Ozark bumpkin, dividing her time between home and Southern California. The show included songs and comedy skits in which Judy would tell stories about her pig lover boy, or about her cousin Urinas, who loved chopped liver ice cream, or about some interesting adventure she'd had. The following clip is from August 31st, 1943.
For a riot of fun, it's America's wistful, wacky, wonderful scatterbrain, Judy Canova.
Howdy, folks. Well, sir, I'm on my way back to Rancho Canova to see how my pig lover boy is getting along. I've had a grand time here in Hollywood, especially last night. They invited me down to the shipyards to launch a ship. You know, they've got quite a system there of christening them boats. If it's a big battleship, they break a bottle of champagne. If it's a destroyer, they break a bottle of port wine. And if it's one of them little old mosquito boats that just hit a sailor over the head with a bottle of Pepsi-Cola. There's a fella right there. Yes, sir. You know, there's a fella there that took charge of me when I arrived. He was an ensign. You know what an ensign is. That's a second lieutenant that can swim. He turned me over to a very, very romantic fella. Yes, sir. He told me he's the chief petting officer. And he took me on a tour of the ship, you know, and when we got way down in the bottom of the ship, it was kind of dark there, and he says, "Here's the hold I was telling you about." I broke the hold and run back upstairs. They told me to put on a pair of them overalls so I wouldn't get dirty and I could watch how the bill shifts. So I saw two fellas there that was playing a nice game. One fella would pick up a little red thing, I think they called it a rivet, with a pair of tongs, and he'd toss it to the other fella and he'd catch it in a little bucket. I thought I'd get in the game, so I intercepted one of them little red things. I caught it in my back pocket. Well, sir, next thing I know, that's 4 miles out to sea under my own steam. But I do love boats. All my ancestors were seafaring folk. My Uncle B was on a tanker for 15 years. The day war was declared, he went on a bender. But getting back to the christening, when the ceremony was over, they give me a military escort home in a jeep. That was some ride with that feller. I can't just describe it, but girls, did you ever wrestle an octopus? Well, sir, when we got in front of my house, he jumped out, grabbed me to him, and planted a big smacking kiss right on my mouth. I struggled loose and says, "Fella, you sure are a fast worker." He says, "I have to be. I was with Doolittle." I says, "Well, you've done enough. Good night."
You're listening to a salute to the great comedians of radio's golden age on That Was Radio. This is WMKY 90.3 FM. I'm Leon Smothers. After her radio program ended in 1955, Canova made personal appearances on many television shows. She also worked on Broadway and in Las Vegas nightclubs through the early 1970s and toured with the musical comedy No No Nanette in 1971. Innocent looking and well endowed, with blonde hair and sparkling eyes, comedian Marie Wilson had portrayed a delightful feather brain in dozens of movies prior to April 1947, when she took the title role in the NBC radio sitcom My Friend Irma. Wilson was cast as Irma Peterson, a legal stenographer who could be described as naively innocent, or more accurately, not very bright. Kathy Lewis played Irma's best friend and roommate, Jane Stacy, who repeatedly demonstrated her fondness for Irma and concern for her well-being. She was particularly exasperated by Irma's fascination with her boyfriend, Al, whom Jane considered to be little more than a street hustler. Al was, in fact, a deadbeat who had frequent scrapes with the law and was consistently unemployed and broke. His primary occupation was attempting to sponge money for his get-rich-quick schemes, which invariably failed. In the following clip, Irma has won a trip to England, and she and Jane are discussing preparations for the trip.
I've got so much to think of and so much to do.
Incidentally, Cookie, what are you going to tell your boss, Mr. Clyde?
Oh, don't worry about him. I can take care of Mr. Clyde.
Sure?
Sure, he'll do anything for me. Doesn't he send me a wire on my birthday every year?
Yeah, I know, and with a note attached to it asking you to hang yourself with it.
Mr. Clyde?
Yes, Miss Peterson?
I'm leaving the country.
What did Al do?
No, I want a free trip.
When are you leaving?
Right away.
Oh, no, you're not. You're not going till you apologize, Mr. Brown.
Mr. Brown?
Yes, Mr. Brown, that letter I dictated to you last week.
Yes?
He's suing me.
Well, why?
I told you to write that Mrs. Brown had complained that there were leaks in the plumbing and that the head of the hot water boiler had spouted steam, causing rust to form on all the pipes. I did not say that there was a leak in Mrs. Brown's head and she was steamed up because Mr. Brown's pipes were all rusty. Now, get on that phone.
All right, Mr. Clyde. Well, what'll I tell Mr. Brown?
You tell him that through a stupid mistake of yours, you got the details of the plumbing confused and you meant nothing against his wife, one of the loveliest women a man can marry.
All that?
Tell it to him.
Okay, hello?
Go on.
Hello, Mr. Brown. This is Miss Peterson. Yeah, Mr. Clyde's secretary. I know it's a lovely mistake, but you must not let the plumbing confuse you just because you were stupid enough to marry Mrs. Brown.
Give me that. Hello. Hello, Brown. Brown, I'll call you later. Please understand. Miss Peterson, get out of here.
Oh, it's so nice to have your blessing. I'll just be in time to get my shot.
Then, by all means, go, and you can tell the people who give you the shots that I'd be honored if they'd use my gun. Now, get out of here.
My Friend Irma ran for 7 years on CBS and was so popular that it spawned two movies and a television program that ran for 2.5 years. Ann Southern was another talented and attractive comedienne. Born in 1909, Southern grew up in Minneapolis with her two sisters and was raised by her mother, who was an opera singer. At the age of 18, she went to Hollywood and got some bit parts, Not satisfied with her movie career at this point, she went to New York and appeared on Broadway for a few years. Her return to Hollywood was more successful than her first endeavors. She made over 20 movies under contract with Columbia and then RKO, mostly in roles as a blonde ingenue. Then MGM cast Southern as Maisie Revere, a tough, down-on-her-luck Brooklyn chorus girl with a heart of gold. The result was a very successful series of 10 movies between 1938 and 1947. In 1945, after the seventh movie, The Adventures of Maisie debuted on radio and ran for 5 years in transcribed syndication from MGM. Maisie was the same sassy and beautiful gal from Brooklyn who was very attracted to, as she said, men of the opposite sex and fell in love often. But she always ended up going off on her own. Here's a clip from an episode from October of 1951.
Hiya, babe. Say, how about... Ouch!
Does that answer your question, buddy?
The Adventures of Maisie, starring Ann Southern. You all remember Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer's famous Maisie pictures. And now, here's Ann Southern as Maisie.
Yep, I'm Maisie, like the man said. Maisie Revere of Brooklyn. I'm in show business, you know. You'll pardon me for always mentioning it, but since my last few jobs have been as stenographer, music teacher, receptionist, wrestling promoter, waitress, and undertaker's assistant, you might forget about the show business part. You see, my heart's in show business, but my stomach insists that I take a few jobs that pay money. But I keep on trying, and right now I'm going to see my, agent, Squirmin Herman. You'd like Herman, that is, if you happen to like weasels. To give you an idea what a sweet guy he is, he got his mother a job as a queen of the powder room at a nightclub, and he charges her 10% commission. But as somebody once said, who wants an honest man for an agent? Well, Herman was glad to see me, he said. Hello, Herman.
Hello, Maisie. Gee, I'm glad to see you, doll. Sorry I can't give any more time, but I'm glad you dropped in. Now, I'll call you as soon as I
hear... Now, wait a minute. You can't brush me off like this, Herman.
Look, Maisie, I'm very busy right now. I'm expecting an important call from Hollywood any minute.
Oh, quit kidding me, Herman. You couldn't accept a collect call from Chicago without going bankrupt. I want to know what you've been doing to get me a job. Come on, tell me a few nice, fat lies.
Maisie, do I ever lie to you?
Herman, you never even once told me the truth.
Well, okay, so I'm a skunk. So sue me. And just when I'm working on a sensational job for you.
The last sensational job you had for me was ringmaster in a flea circus.
This is nothing like that.
You mean this is nothing, period. Why don't you go out and get me a decent job at a decent salary for a change?
Look, Maisie, if you don't like the representation you're getting, you don't have to stay with me. Get another crook to handle you.
Oh, now relax, Herman. There's only one complaint I got. You never sell me anywhere.
You aren't easy to sell, Maisie. You got too much experience. What producers want is an inexperienced, fresh young girl who's been in the theater all her life. You don't fit into that caricature.
Maybe I'd better get another agent.
Yeah, why don't you? In the meantime, I'll let you know if I get anything for you, but don't call me. I'll call you.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that before, too. I'll take it.
Maisie!
Hello? Yes, this is his confidential secretary speaking. I see. Well, confidentially, it doesn't surprise me. Yeah. Goodbye.
Maisie, you can't do that. This is a bigger organization than you realize. I'm no coffee and cakes agent. I'm making important money. Who was that? Some important actor, I suppose?
It was the telephone company, and they're disconnecting your phone.
After Maisie, Ann Southern had a long career in movies, starred in 2 television shows, and appeared on many others. The African-American character Beulah Brown was created and performed by a white man, Marlon Hurt, around 1939. Over the next few years, Hurt and the character Beulah appeared in a couple of NBC network programs with moderate success. Then, in early 1944, Beulah debuted as the maid on the Fibber McGee and Molly show. The character was so well received by the McGee listeners that, a little over a year later, Marlon Hurt and Beulah moved over to CBS to work for a new family on their own program. Much like Rochester on the Jack Benny program, Beulah was far less subservient than sarcastic. She was respected by her employers as hardworking and full of sound advice that she more than willingly dispensed. It was apparent from the beginning that Beulah was considered more a part of the family than an employee. While this certainly was not a realistic representation of the position of black servants of the time, it was accepted and enjoyed by the program's listeners. Hurt continued in the role until his death in 1946. He was then replaced by another white man, Bob Corley. Corley's portrayal of the role was not well received, and within 6 months, the show was canceled. After a short hiatus, the show resumed, and in a stroke of creative genius, a black woman was cast in the role. The woman was Hattie McDaniel, a veteran of minstrel shows, radio, and the movies, and, of course, the first black actor to win an Academy Award. And in 1947, she became the first African-American woman to star in a radio sitcom. With McDaniel in the role, Beulah was now a character with depth. Her sassy demeanor had just the right combination of humor and dignity to make her a truly endearing character. In the following clip, we hear McDaniel playing Beulah in an episode from June 1950.
Better start getting this lunch ready for the folks.
Hi, Beulah.
Oh, howdy, Mr. Harry. I'll have a little lunch ready in a minute.
Well, that's good. By the way, Beulah, what are we having for lunch today?
Same as every day this week, Mr. Harry. Enchiladas, tamales, chili, beans, Spanish rice, and hot peppers.
Yeah.
You know, you and Miss Alice gave me those orders yourselves to prepare you for that trip to Mexico.
Yes, I know we did. But, Beulah, couldn't we have just one side dish of something else today? Something plain?
But I thought you wanted all this hot stuff, Mr. Harry.
Beulah, frankly, I just can't face another bite of it. My mouth feels like it's on fire.
So does mine, Mr. Harry. I ate some marshmallows yesterday, and by the time I swallowed them, they were toasted.
Well, that's no surprise. I don't see how the people in Mexico eat this food all the time. It is just too darn hot.
And maybe that's why there's such good rumba dances, Mr. Harry.
Hmm?
Once you put something like this in your stomach, the rest of you's got to start waiting to try to cool you off.
Yep, you might be right at that. Oh, and by the way, Beulah, don't mention this to Mrs. Henderson. She'll think I can't take it or something.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Just serve something plain besides all this Mexican food. For me.
Okay, Mr. Harris.
Good. Now, what can you make that'll be perfectly plain, completely unspiced, that'll cool off my poor throat?
Well, how about a nice big dish of ice cubes?
I'd love it. But I really think I'll settle for some cold milk and Rice Krispies.
Rice Krispies?
Yeah.
Oh, I get it, Mr. Harris.
You get what?
This time you want the food to snap, popple, and crackle instead of your stomach. Here comes lunch, folks.
Oh, good. What have you got there, Beulah?
Enchiladas, hot tamales, chili beans, hot peppers, and some Rice Krispies and milk.
Oh, everything looks delicious. Let's dig in, Alice.
Yes, right, honey. Boy.
Alice.
Yes, dear.
Did you have to take all the Rice Krispies and milk?
Looks like someone else is tired of Mexican food.
What was that, Beulah?
I said some people like chicken fried and some like it stewed.
Well, either way's all right with me. Alice, why not let me take some of that cereal? And you can have these delicious enchiladas and hot tamales and all this chili
Harry,
and beans.
Harry,
I've got news for you. I can't stand another bite of this food.
You what?
I don't even want to go to Mexico anymore.
You don't? Well, honey, if that's the way you feel, we can go somewhere else.
Oh, well, dear, you were so anxious to go to Mexico, and you're so crazy about this Mexican food.
Darling, baby, where you're concerned, my own feelings don't matter.
Love that man.
You're listening to That Was Radio on WMKY 90.3 FM. I'm Leon Smothers. Hattie McDaniel was in the role of Beulah until she became ill in 1951. From then until the show was canceled in 1953, Beulah was played first by Lillian Randolph and then by her sister Amanda Randolph. Both were also African Americans and born in Louisville, Kentucky. Eve Arden again fits the model of multi-talented performer and outstanding comedian. Prior to becoming America's favorite teacher, Arden had performed in repertory theater, been a member of Ziegfeld Follies, had parts in several movies, including Mildred Pierce, for which she earned an Academy Award nomination, and had appeared in numerous radio shows. Then in 1948, Arden brought a unique comic style of wisecracks mixed with insightful observations to CBS Radio, portraying an English teacher at Madison High School on Our Miss Brooks. Arden's monotone delivery in portraying Connie Brooks showed her to be a straightforward, common-sense type of gal. Except when it came to her semi-unrequited affection for Mr. Boynton, the school's biology teacher. It was obvious that Miss Brooks cared about her students and tried to keep them out of trouble while often getting herself into trouble. All in all, her job would have been delightful except for continually butting heads with Mr. Conklin, the school's boisterous and bullying principal, who seemed out to make her life miserable. The program was very popular at the time, running for 9 years, and it's still one of the most popular with old-time radio fans today.
Our Miss Brooks, starring Eve Arden. Last Friday was Student Government Day, a day upon which the entire administration of the city is handed over to high school pupils who have been elected by their classmates. Well, ordinarily, our Miss Brooks, who teaches English at Madison High School, would have very little to do with this event.
But unfortunately, Miss Johnson, the civics teacher, took ill on Thursday, and our principal, Mr. Conklin, suggested that I take over her class. Of course, I didn't have to accept the assignment. I just figured that teaching is better than being totally unemployed. In some states, it's better. At any rate, I conducted Miss Johnson's civics class on Thursday, and on the subject, What Would I Do If I Held Public Office, the class and I had quite a spirited discussion. But Friday morning, the entire student body and faculty gathered in the assembly hall to hear Mr. Conklin officially proclaim it Student Government Day. Mr. Boynton, my bashful biologist, was sitting in the front row, and accidentally, with the aid of two bloodhounds, I found myself sitting right next to him.
Oh, hello, Miss Brooks.
Why, Mr. Boynton, this is a surprise. To you, anyway.
I didn't see you sit down. I believe I left my notebook on that seat. It's just some lecture notes on the North American porcupine.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Boynton, I didn't even notice it. He must have pulled in his quills. Here you are.
Well, thanks. I'll just hold it in my lap.
Why don't we let the notebook have the seat and you could hold... No, not in school, I
guess. You know, Miss Brooks, something just occurred to me. We're always sitting next to each other in assembly. Fate seems to be throwing us together.
Compared to my throwing, fate is a sandlot pitcher. But perhaps you're right, Mr. Boynton. Maybe we should give fate a helping hand. I'm free for lunch today. How about you? Or would you rather ask me? Or am I being too subtle? Oh, darn that bell. I'll have to get him in the next round.
After our Miss Brooks left radio, Arden starred in three television shows, first reprising the role of Miss Brooks, followed by The Eve Arden Show and The Mothers-in-Law. She also appeared on other TV shows and in additional movies. In the early days of television, summer replacements seldom went very far, primarily because they were only intended to fill a gap while the real shows were on vacation. My Little Margie, starring Gail Storm, was the summer replacement for I Love Lucy in 1952. Before landing the role as Margie, Storm had appeared in about 40 low-budget movies and was not exactly a household name. In any case, according to reports from the time, the program caught on quickly, and audiences came to like Margie almost as much as Lucy. So at the beginning of 1953, Storm's show got its own TV slot. In a reversal of the trend of the period, where radio programs were shifting to television, a radio version of My Little Margie debuted in mid-December 1952, and it too was a success. In this program, Storm plays Margie Albright, a 20-something who is determined to make her father behave himself. Mr. Albright, played by Charles Farrell, a former star in silent films, is a dashing and debonair man who refuses to recognize that he's not as young as he used to be, and the proverbial hijinks ensue. Both the TV and radio versions of the program ended in the summer of 1955.
Little Margie, starring Gail Storm and Charles Farrell, transcribed in Hollywood. In the Albright apartment high above Park Avenue today, Margie and her father are busy making plans. Vern has a few days off, and he and Margie are trying to decide where to spend them.
Margie, let's fly down to Bermuda. The swimming is great there this time of year.
No, thanks. It's awfully dangerous on the beach.
Why? The sharks come too close?
No, the wolves go too far.
Well, okay.
Oh, here's a travel folder from a dude ranch in Arizona. They've got both hiking and horseback riding at this resort.
Hiking and horseback riding?
Mm-hmm. Guests who travel on foot and guests who ride horses.
Yes, sir. One man's blisters, another man's callus.
You're not interested in a dude ranch, I take it.
I'm not interested in a dude ranch. You got it. Boy, I wish I had more time. I'd really go places. To be in Paris during the Spring Festival. To be in Holland during the Tulip Festival.
To be in Hoboken during the Pizza Festival.
Mrs. Odette.
Your friendly neighbor.
Mrs. Odette, you've been spying on us again.
Oh, I don't know. There's two ways of looking at it.
Yeah, through the keyhole and over the transom.
So you want to go away for a few days, huh?
Mm-hmm. Dad and I'd like to take a little trip somewhere.
Oh, I'll never forget a trip I once made. I went from Chicago to Cleveland, then back to Chicago, then on to Pittsburgh, then back to Chicago, and then...
Wait a minute. Why'd you keep rushing back to Chicago?
My suspenders were caught on the Wrigley Building.
Your suspenders? You don't wear suspenders.
Have you ever seen me in slacks?
Heaven forbid. I couldn't tell you from the Wrigley Building.
Well, now, if you'll permit me, I'll suggest a place to visit. Hollywood. Ooh, it's wonderful. Have you ever been there?
Yes, and it is wonderful. The minute I stepped off the train, I was walking on air.
Walking on air?
Yes. The porter forgot to put the stool down.
Well, Hollywood is a thought. Would you like
hi,
to go
everybody.
To...
Hi, everybody.
Oh, hi there, Freddie.
Am I interrupting anything?
Yes, you are.
Dad and I are planning a little trip for a few days.
Travel, huh? Boy, I wish I could travel.
Why can't you?
Well, if a trip around the world cost $1, I couldn't even get out of sight.
Well, here's $2. Stay out of sight.
Mr. Albright, I am going to ignore that remark, even though I am a sensitive type of youth. Have you decided where you're going, Margie?
Well, we were thinking of California.
California?
Mm-hmm.
When you can go to Las Vegas? Fabulous, romantic, glamorous Las Vegas. It's the only place where you can come away with a small fortune.
Yeah, if you went there with a big one.
You know, Las Vegas does sound attractive. Think of the nightlife there.
And all the movie stars.
And all the big shows and the fancy swimming pools. Boy, if I was going, that's where I'd go.
Well, for suggesting the ideal spot for our trip, I'm rewarding you by taking you along, too.
Oh, boy.
Gee, Dad, you're aces.
In Las Vegas, that's a good thing to be.
Mr. Albright, would you mind if I went along, too? Paying my own way, of course.
Oh, not at all, Mrs. Odette. Glad to have you.
Thank you. You know, I've never seen modern Las Vegas, although I was there once before the town got so big. I remember I got a traffic ticket there.
Oh, what for? For double parking your covered wagon?
After Margie, Gail Storm had another television program, The Gail Storm Show, that ran for 4 years. That completes our program about the prominent women in primetime radio comedy. If you'd like to learn more, I recommend Arthur Wertheim's book, Radio Comedy, Jim Cox's The Great Radio Sitcoms, and Leora and Luther C's The Encyclopedia of Women in Radio. You've been listening to That Was Radio, where we discuss old-time radio programs and the people and events that shaped them. I hope you've enjoyed this program and will join me the next time. I'm Leon Smothers, and this is Morehead State Public Radio, WMKY 90.3 FM.